I will briefly introduce Dr. Walter B. Denny. He's a professor of art history at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst and the Charles Grant Ellis Research Associate in Oriental Carpets at the Textile Museum. He's an expert on the art and architecture of the Islamic world and the author of many publications on Islamic art, art of the Ottoman Turks, textile and carpet history, art of the Islamic book, and among them is the crescent and the rose, Ottoman imperial silks and velvets, which is very closely related to our exhibition style and status. Dr. Denny has also been the curator of several exhibitions worldwide and was a contributor to the PBS series Islam, Empires of Faith. I'll turn the program over to him.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm delighted to be here. I gave a lecture from this stage in 1971. It was my first big lecture. I was 27 years old. Don't do the math; you'll figure out how old I am. And my first big lecture of my academic career. And then I waited 32 years to come back. But I've been on this stage now 3 times in the last 4 months. So I'm beginning to feel quite like this is really where I belong. I have to tell you that. One of the things that has been a characteristic of my career as a lecturer, and I give lots of lectures, is that I pride myself on never giving the same lecture twice. And unfortunately, I'm in a position today where I've been asked to lecture on a subject that I have lectured on now in one form or another in the last year 4 times. And worse than that, all of them in Washington, D.C., beginning with a lecture for the Mosaic Foundation at the World Bank, another one for the Mosaic Foundation at the Textile Museum. The other sort of limitation I'm facing this afternoon, in addition to trying desperately to talk, to say something new about a subject I've already talked about in Washington, my other thing is that today I'm really, I was asked to make this talk specifically directed to these 20 young people who are here for this special course, this sort of January term study of this remarkable exhibition at the Sackler. And these are people who are either studying weaving or they are studying textiles. They're studying textiles or they are studying fashion design. Two subjects which, well, textiles, I like to think I know a fair amount about. Fashion design, let me just say, I hope I'm a quicker study than it may appear to be to all of you. These are the constraints that basically within which I'm operating this afternoon. My topic is mainly about what we would call, there's a fancy name for what I'm going to talk about today that's come up in the past few years. It's called reception. That is, how an artistic tradition or how works of art are accepted or viewed outside of their own original environment. Because every work of art has the life of its own creation when its artist creates it, and then, of course, an afterlife, as long as people enjoy the work of art, as long as people draw inspiration from the work of art, as long as that work of art continues to amuse or to please or to motivate or to bore or to infuriate people, that work of art has its afterlife, and this afterlife is not necessarily confined to the milieu in which the work of art was created. I mean, that's a truism. That's why people like me can make a living talking about the history of art. But in particular, what I'm talking about today is about the reception and the interest in Ottoman textiles outside of the Ottoman Empire. Now, if you want to read about the reception of Ottoman textiles, the beautiful ceremonial figured silks that are in this exhibition, inside the Ottoman Empire, you can do no better than buying the very abbreviated, what you might call the first fascicle of the book Epek. You don't have to spend a lot of money, well over $100, I'm sure, on that great, big, beautiful book that's on sale in the fair shop with a special discount to members of the Smithsonian Institution. You can buy the abbreviated version, and in that, basically what we did is we included the very first chapter of the big book, Epek, which talks to you about how these textiles were used in the Ottoman Empire. But my interest today is not about that at all. It is about how these textiles were viewed everywhere but the Ottoman Empire. Now, Islamic textiles, because of their great beauty, their extraordinary technology, and because they were made out of a material, silk, the secret of which was basically either not understood or not fully exploited in Europe for a very, very long time, Islamic textiles have long been popular outside of the Islamic world. And they have also been produced on the interface between the Islamic and the non-Islamic world, giving us some of the greatest and most storied monuments of Islamic art that end up in all of the textbooks, including, I might parenthetically add, the brand new Islamic chapter being added back into Janssen's History of Art, 7th edition, which will appear in early February from Prentice Hall. I wrote the Islamic chapter, and the slide on the left-hand side here is reproduced in color in that chapter because it's one of the most fabulous of all Islamic artworks. It is a coronation robe made out of embroidered silk, silk embroidered with more silk and pearls, made for the Norman ruler of Sicily, Roger II, in the 12th century. That is well over 800 years ago. And it shows iconographically a Norman lion triumphing over a Fatimid Arab camel because he had conquered Sicily from the Muslims. And the inscription around the outside in Arabic, lists Roger's styles and titles and heaps praise upon him. I mean, it's the usual Arab business, you know, glory and honor and good health and long life and majesty and power to our Lord the Emperor. And then you expect somebody like Abdulaziz, and instead it's Roger, you know. So this is a good example of a work of art that not only was between cultures when it was created. Again, this is the cope or the robe on the left-hand side. But it was also... Then it made its way into the treasury of the Habsburgs. Today it's found in Vienna in the Schatzkammer, in the treasure house of the Hofburg, the city palace of the Habsburg emperors in Vienna. And it was used for many, many centuries as the coronation robe of the Holy Roman Emperor. Isn't that interesting that the Holy Roman Emperor would have been basically crowned wearing an Islamic textile? And that is no more or no less unusual than the rather strange-looking piece of furniture you see on the right-hand side here, which is the throne which was built for the coronation of Ivan IV Grozny, the Terrible, in the Cathedral of the Adoration of the Virgin in the Moscow Kremlin in the 1540s. And the throne is lined with Turkish textiles. For in those days, no one knew how to weave figured silks. In the draw loom technology had not made its way into Russia, and therefore the emblematic textiles of the Russian Empire, of the Russian Kingdom of Muscovy, to become the great Russian Empire, were actually almost always Turkish as well. Now, Islamic textiles also were quickly associated in the West, somewhat paradoxically, with the idea of religious ritual. For example, the painting on the left-hand side, done in the early 16th century by an anonymous French painter we know simply as the Master of Saint-Gilles. It shows the altar of Saint-Denis, the famous altar that Abbot Suger built at the Abbey of Saint-Denis in Paris in the early Gothic period, perished in the French Revolution, so this is the only record we have of it, the only really good record. And there is an identifiable Turkish carpet on the floor as the priest says Mass, and there is an Islamic ogival silk damask textile draped over the altar right here, and there is another Islamic textile with the fleur-de-lis interposed into it, on the edge of the altar itself. And most of you know what a chasuble is. It's a clerical vestment that sort of looks like a sandwich board. It's got basically two large paddles, one that hangs down the front, one that hangs down the back, and it's open on the sides. This is a Roman Catholic chasuble, today kept also in Vienna and the Museum of Applied Arts in Vienna, and it is created out of Turkish silk. So from early on, Ottoman silks, although they were absolutely not invested with any religious significance whatsoever in the Ottoman Empire, acquired religious significance outside of it. Now, why did I say the first half of that sentence? Well, silk, you see, in the Islamic world is luxury, and Islam is, like parts of Christianity and certainly like Judaism, an extraordinarily puritanical religion. The wearing of silk is absolutely forbidden in the Islamic world. There are many, many traditions associated with the Prophet Muhammad that say that it's an abomination for men to wear silk. Very interesting, isn't it? And the prophet has even been alleged to have said, he who wears silk in this world will never wear it in the next. But of course, you never wear silk on your body. You wear a cotton garment, and the cotton wears the silk. That's why we have theologians. So here we have two works of art that had only secular importance in their own culture, that have acquired the significance of holy ground and a priest vestment in the West. Sometimes it is true the reception of a work of art is at least as fascinating, sometimes even more fascinating, than its original genesis. Now, textiles also reach the West as cultural trophies, Islamic textiles. For example, on the left-hand side, here is a famous flag. It's known as the Bandera del Salado. It was an Almohad Muslim war banner. It was captured by the Christian forces at the crucial battle in 1212 of Las Navas de Tolosa, which basically was the beginning of the end of Islam in Spain, one of the greatest battles of the Christian reconquest of the Iberian Peninsula. And today it's hung as a trophy in the monastery of Las Huelgas near Burgos in Spain. And so frequently these textiles that were symbols of the fallen might of the military adversary became quite famous and were revered and kept as trophies and admired in non-Islamic collections. The same is certainly true of the most magnificent collection of Turkish tents outside of Turkey, which is in the Wawel Castle in Krakow in Poland. And this enormous tent here, one of five magnificent applique tents, were captured at the Polish sack of the Turkish camp outside of Vienna in 1683. And so these trophies here were then exhibited as two kinds of things, really as tokens of Polish military prowess at having defeated the Turks, but also to show you how extraordinarily powerful and cultured and rich and amazing the culture of their enemy was at the same time. Now, I mentioned this business of textiles being used for Christian ritual, but in fact, in the West, in their reception, Ottoman textiles were also thought of even as, and Islamic textiles in general, as symbols of holiness. We saw them as symbols of princely power. Here they are as symbols of holiness. How many Italian paintings have you looked at of Madonna and Child? And if you look very closely, you would find that the borders on the textiles, or even the halos themselves, have approximations, almost never really readable, but approximations of Arabic script. Because Arabic script decorated beautiful pieces of metalwork, and a halo was, I guess, a kind of a piece of metalwork, a metal plate in a way, and they decorated Islamic textiles. And so in order to show that something was extraordinary, out of the ordinary, indeed in this case divine, the Islamic textile was appropriate, as is this Turkish bursa velvet robe shown on St. Stephen. Every iconostasis at every Greek church has a representation of the early martyr St. Stephen. This one in the Arkhangelsky or the Archangel Cathedral of the Moscow Kremlin is quite interesting because it shows St. Stephen wearing a robe which is in fact a Christian vestment, but it's made entirely and recognizably out of early 17th century Ottoman Turkish velvet. Now, textiles were well enough known. I talked on this similar subject here at the symposium at the Fair about a month ago, and I tried to point out that in earlier times, Europeans knew a great deal about Turkish textiles, and especially if you were from Venice. In Venice, you knew a great deal. You knew all about Turkish rugs. Back in the 15th century, they were extremely knowledgeable. They had very good taste. After all, they had the Bellinis working for them. They were about to have Titian and Giorgione and a few other not-so-bad painters like that in their midst. They knew what good things were, and they recognized these textiles, and therefore these textiles instantaneously served in the in the the representations of these textiles served in the hands of a capable painter very quickly in showing you where an event is taking place. This is from Carpaccio's Life of St. Stephen, and this is just a detail of the painting in the Louvre, and you know that St. Stephen is preaching in the Middle East because his listeners are dressed in Middle Eastern costumes. Never mind that these are the Middle Eastern costumes of the time the painting was painted and not the Middle Eastern costumes of 1,500 years before when St. Stephen was preaching, but you get the idea. Likewise, King Herod over here, a detail of a massacre of the innocents by a Sienese painter, Matteo Di Giovanni, in the 15th century. He shows the evil King Herod, and he's wearing, of course, a turban to show that he's a Muslim. This is demonization, of course, something that, of course, would never happen in the early 21st century. And he's wearing a robe which, by its closures and its fur trim, identifies it by its cut and by its fabric, immediately identifies him as a Middle Easterner, and therefore it identifies the painting as being of an event that took place in the Middle East. Now, textiles were, in fact, very, very easily shipped, and Venetians knew a lot about Ottoman silks, and Europeans knew a lot about Ottoman silks because they were being brought into Europe in vast numbers. There was a huge trade in these luxury goods at the time we're talking about, the 15th and 16th centuries. They didn't know so much directly, however, about costumes because, of course, nobody wore that particular fashion. But they did know a lot about costumes from a different reason, and that is that, of course, Venetians themselves were going all the time to the Middle East. And in the late 15th century, one of the greatest of the Venetians, Gentile Bellini, was asked, the oldest son of Jacopo Bellini, was asked to come to Istanbul to do a portrait of the Turkish Sultan. And while he was there, he not only did the oil portrait of the Turkish Sultan, but I believe he did this painting in opaque watercolors over here of one of his own counterparts. That is, he was a Venetian artist, and here's a Turkish artist at work. And he was very, very careful in showing not only the pattern of the silk, but also in very great detail the cut of this elaborate robe, which is being worn by his counterpart here. He also made a series of drawings of both male and female costume with his own notations on them as to what colors, if they were to be turned into a painting, what colors he would turn them in, and also information on the cut as well. As was remarked in the previous lecture, the cut of Middle Eastern costumes is, in fact, rather simple. Because the designs are of such an enormous scale, the idea of having lots of gathers or slashes or gores or pleats or any of the other things you can do with fabric, because it in fact breaks up the artistry of the pattern in the fabric, it is in these large, especially these large-scale ceremonial costumes that were meant to be seen from enormous distances away as a means of sort of projecting the costume through a sort of a visual loudspeaker. That's why the designs in the exhibition, many of them are on such a gigantic scale. This large scale, of course, militates against a lot of fancy cutting. In the middle of the 16th century, the Habsburg ambassador to the Ottoman court says, the fabrics that they wear are the most unbelievably beautiful things you've ever seen in your life. But the cut is extraordinarily simple. Everything is cut very voluminously. He said, the effect of this is to make people look much larger and more noble than they actually are. Whereas our costumes, by which he means the costumes of the Habsburg court in Vienna and in Spain at the time, frequently show the human body in all of its ugliness and often show things that would be better left unseen. Now, a very, very rare noble Muslim made it to the West. Only one real famous example, and that is in the very end of the 15th century, a fugitive brother of one of the reigning Turkish sultans. His name was Cem Sultan. He made his way to Italy, and so there were actually a sort of eyewitness accounts as to what beautiful Turkish costumes looked like, and we see these in a few European paintings. This painting here by Pinturicchio is in the Borgia apartments in the Vatican. There was a Borgia pope. The Borgias were Spanish, but they became popes in Borgia was pope around 1500. And of course, this was not so good for Cem Sultan because, Ogden Nash's most wonderful poem. It's a very short one. And it's about the nephew of the pope, who commissioned this painting, what would you do if you were up a dark alley with Cesare Borgia and he was coming toward you? Well, in fact, Pope Alexander, Cesare's father, poisoned Borgia, Sultan, upon the payment of a certain assassination fee by his brother. But not, fortunately, before Pinturicchio could actually show him in his underkaftan and overkaftan. So the Europeans, Europeans projected these royal costumes of the Middle East onto one of their most favorite painting subjects. For centuries, European painters have loved one subject from the life of Jesus more than any other. They had to do the crucifixion because it's doctrinally so important. But if a painter really wanted to extend himself, he showed the adoration of the three kings. And so we see the three kings, when the three kings come to worship the infant Jesus, that's the opportunity for the European painter to pull out all of the stops on his Islamic visual pipe organ and show the most gorgeous fabrics that he can. Now, in a later time, one can actually see in certain parts of Europe not only the use of fabrics of the Ottoman Empire, but every once in a while, and in one very conspicuous case, oh, actually two conspicuous or three conspicuous cases, all of them in Eastern Europe, examples of national noble costume that was very strongly affected by the cut as well as the fabrics of the Ottomans as we see them in the exhibition. And the most famous of these cases is probably Poland. Now, Poland was very and has always been quite schizophrenic in its feelings about the Turks, because although it was the Poles who were the heroes who saved the day in 1683, raiding the Turkish camp at Vienna, coming down the slopes of the Kahlenberg on the Turkish camp while the Turkish soldiers were in the trenches around the city of Vienna and sacking and looting the camp and causing the great Turkish retreat from Europe, that this cataclysmic retreat that 17 years later resulted in the Peace of Karlowitz and basically the end of the Ottoman Empire in Central Europe. The Poles, in addition to this military anti-Turkish history, were great admirers of Turkish culture. And the wearing of this silk, this particular type of silk sash that you see here on a Polish nobleman's costume is something that not only comes from the Middle East, but the sashes themselves were made in the Middle East. When Turkish fabrics came into Poland, here is a sleeveless kaftan in a fabric known as saraser, worn by the master of the horse of the Polish court in the year 1607. We don't know the name of the painter, we just know he came from what the Poles call Lvov and what the Ukrainians call Lviv. And you can see he's wearing this Turkish overgarment, and then he has his Polish garment on underneath, and then you can see he also has the curved sword, which is a Polish adaptation of Turkish arms and armor as well. Now, we also know that these sleeveless kaftans were very, very popular in Russia. And I'm sorry, this is not the most wonderful detail in the world. There was a lot of varnish on this painting, but we have many, many representations in the historical paintings kept in the Moscow museums. They're very seldom ever displayed, to my great disappointment. But if you go into storage, you'll see nobleman after nobleman. In this particular case, this particular nobleman is wearing a Persian undergarment here, Persian silk, and the kaftan on top is a large-scale Turkish velvet. Or over here, even earlier representation of members of the Bulgarian aristocracy of the 15th century in a monastery church. And there's a priest over here. We know that's a priest costume. But if you look carefully, you can see the ogival patterned silks of the Ottoman Empire being worn in these garments of these other characters here. So just as in the late 17th, early 18th century, the French style of Versailles was so powerful in Europe that even the mortal enemies of the French, the Germans and the Dutch and everybody else, and the English, they were all affected by this great style of France. And so the same thing is true here. We have the Ottoman style affecting even their political adversaries in the realm of clothing, which, as you know, is the most intimate and personally expressing of all of the art forms. Now, in a later period, by the middle of the 17th century, what happens is that there are changes which we can see, and one of them is, oh, before we get there, I want to, these are a couple of these Polish sashes. And it's very interesting. Most of them are uninscribed, but this one up here actually has an inscription on it here. And I don't know if you can see it. It says it's the work of Yusufovitz of Constantinople. And we know that these are weavers were actually who worked for the Poles. They were not Muslims. They were Ottoman Christians. They were Armenians. And his name Jacob. But we've got the Owitz on the end of this is probably simply the Polish translation of the Armenian Ion ending. So you know you've got Yakubian, a very common Armenian name, and it's just been translated into Polish on the sash here. So that's the real link, that we know that these sashes actually come from Constantinople. Now we see a different kind of Orientalism in the costume, viewing the costume in the Middle East, certainly in something like this. Two famous paintings by Rembrandt. One, his so-called portrait of a Turk. I don't know what kind of a Turk this was. Probably just a dark-haired neighbor. And this one over here, Belshazzar's Feast. We know that Rembrandt liked to go to basically the 17th century Dutch equivalent of garage sales and buy fancy costumes. We have the entire inventory. When he went bankrupt, you know, his whole house was sold off and all of his possessions. And there's a very meticulous inventory of everything. He was a real obsessive compulsive collector. And he loved these costumes, but he used these costumes in the very same way, actually, that the 15th century Italian painters did, in order to establish venue, that is to show where these events are taking place. Now, it's a truism that you cannot use a sign to signify something unless your audience knows what the sign means. So for me, the really interesting thing about Rembrandt's using all of this Oriental stuff is not that he had an entire closet full of it on the fourth floor of his house on the Odenbreedstraat in Amsterdam. What really is interesting about Rembrandt's using this stuff is that when he did paint people like this, he knew exactly what his audience knew exactly what inferences to draw from looking at the costumes. In other words, that costumes of the Middle East had a very wide acceptance as to what they were in Europe. And this goes on for centuries in European tradition if you look at European painting. One of the things that Europeans like to do at a later time is to dress up in Oriental costume. By Oriental, of course, I mean Islamic costume. You remember the famous scene from David Lean's movie Lawrence of Arabia, of Lawrence trying out his new white robe and running around in circles and pirouetting and looking generally rather ridiculous. Well, this is Edward Wortley Montagu, the British ambassador to the Sublime Porte in the early 17th century, a la Turca, dressed up like a Turk. And this is the famous 19th century British Orientalist painter, David Roberts, shown in Oriental costume. He's a Scotsman. He doesn't look terribly fierce up here, right? Edward actually looks like he might cut off a head or two, but David Roberts sort of looks like he's longing for a haggis or something. But the fact is that this was a very, very common sort of thing. Now, there have been various theories advanced for this. Those people who really think that Edward Said had it right, and I have to tell you, I don't count myself among them, believe that by dressing yourself up in the costume of your adversary, you are showing your superiority. You are taking on, you are becoming superior to your adversary, I guess. That's an interesting idea. It doesn't follow to me very much. But at any rate, I don't think that's what's going on here. I think that these people, just like Busbeck, realize that, hey, you know, what opportunity did an Englishman have to wear anything nice in the 19th century? It was black. It was a black. Everything was black. I mean, you know, people ask me why I wear a tie, even wear a tie at home on Saturday morning. Hey, it's the only chance I get to ever wear anything nice. Everything else is just so ordinary. So I think what we have here is simply, quite frankly, the cost they were very comfortable to wear, and these are people we both know. We know both of these people had tremendous respect for the cultures of the Islamic world, and they spent large parts of their life there. And so why not? And then of course, when we get into the world of what our first speaker of the afternoon called fashion, we do begin to see Islamic elements incorporated, not always Turkish, but Islamic elements incorporated in European fashion. A good example would be the rage for Paisley shawls and Persian shawls of various sorts that existed in France in the late Napoleonic Empire and in the period of the Bourbon Restoration. This is an Ingres painting, and there are many, many paintings of this period showing women with the obligatory accessory of the Persian shawl. In men's costume, well, now this is an idealized portrait of Lord Byron dressed in Ottoman Greek costume right here. But in men's costume, it actually had a much more interesting sort of impact on the West, and that is that men put on silk robes and silk hats and silk slippers at home, and specifically they put them on to indulge in an Oriental vice, the smoking of cigarettes. That is the so-called smoking jacket and all of its accessories. It was perfectly okay to dress yourself up like a Turk, if you were going to go and have a pipe or a cigar or something even more interesting in the late afternoon or in the evening. And so that's the way that men's fashion began to be affected in the 19th century by Islamic costume. So there are all kinds of social, economic, and political implications of the way that one people will learn about or adopt or draw inspiration from the costume of another. I have no idea wasn't there a Nehru jacket fad? Yes, I'm really showing how old I am here. None of the young folks here who are studying here, the people I'm really supposed to be talking to, would have the faintest idea what I'm talking about. Or Mao jackets. Oh God, it makes one just feel grateful to have lived through it. You know, and to come out the other end without being warped. But in fact, these things still happen. They happen all the time, and it's part of fashion. And so one might say that this tradition that begins in the 15th century has really been with us ever since. Now I want to talk very, very briefly here about a couple of small subjects within this broader subject. The first is about the Roman Catholic and Russian Orthodox church vestments made from Ottoman textiles. Now, nobody today much thinks about ecclesiastical costume. One of the reasons for it is that ecclesiastical costume today is largely caught in a sort of a time warp. If you look at what a big city cathedral priestly staff will wear during the most important festive masses of the year, they are going to be in cut absolutely identical to the 15th, 16th, century examples we're looking at, that is for the last 700 years, basically, but certainly since the Council of Trent in the end of the 16th century, Roman Catholic vestments have barely changed at all. The only difference is that they're using basically today to get this kind of heavy brocaded fabric that they need, they're basically using material that I think, when I look at many a priest walking down the aisle, I think he really looks like he's wearing something that was designed to cover a couch or a chair or something of that sort. But in fact, in these sandwich boards of the chasuble and in the enormous copes, these huge capes worn as part of the Roman Catholic ceremony, the large scale of Ottoman textiles with these row after row of gigantic carnation flowers adapts very beautifully to this, and it serves exactly the same function in the church that is broadcasting priestly power and authority to a huge, immense audience that it did in the court of the Ottoman Sultan. One of the interesting things that happens, however, in order to assert Christian dominance is one could read a political message, I think, into an awful lot of these chasubles, and that is that the fabric is manifestly Turkish here, and this is a very rare Turkish fabric, the much prized sera cloth of silver and gold, again with huge carnations here. But what you see here is that there is a central embroidered panel in each one of these. What it does is it takes full advantage of the beauty of the Turkish fabric, but then it superimposes a layer of, shall we say, Roman Catholic religion on top of these foreign silks. Just in case the audience was wondering, and by the time that these vestments were made, people recognized these as foreign silks, not as domestic ones. This allowed them to become, let's say, more acceptable. Even in a place with its own wonderful weaving traditions since the 15th century in silk, like Italy, we occasionally see this. In the course of working on the 12 years that we worked on the Silk Book, from 1990 to 2002, in Rome, Louise Mackey discovered a complete set of matching vestments made originally for a Barberini Pope, now in the Barberini family in Rome, including the chasuble here and the stola over here, made out of the very, very same cloth, Turkish cloth. And there were several other different vestments there. There was actually, I believe, a dalmatic, that is the complete robe, and the cope that were all made to match out of this same series of vestments. But the forms are obviously Christian. This is quite Roman Catholic. The stola you find in both Orthodox and Catholic ritual. Another way in which these two cultures blended in a very interesting way, which I've mentioned in my symposium talk I gave here a month ago, is in these extraordinary textiles which were made in Istanbul, in Constantinople, specifically for liturgical purposes in the Orthodox Church. These are Ottoman textiles. You can tell by looking at here are tulips, here are the three dots of the Chintamani, here are all the Turkish flowers, but it's the Virgin Mary with the Christ child in her lap and an attendant angel. Or over here, Jesus on a throne surrounded by the symbols of the four evangelists and the inscription above saying, Christ the Victor. This is something else that in which we take the technology of Ottoman silks and adapt its iconography to these liturgical costumes. And by the way, you know, the cut of what's called a sakos, which is a Byzantine or Russian dalmatic, is only in the small details different from the cut of the kaftan, or the Turkish ceremonial robe used at the Turkish court, the only difference being this heavily embroidered placket up the middle. Now, Oriental textiles have another life in the West, and that has to do with sex. And that is the image of the harem. You see, the whole image of the harem in the West is one of the silliest, most contradictory sorts of things. I mean, first of all, can you think of anything? Well, Europeans, in their imagination, I guess, thought it was very sexy for a man to have four wives. But just ponder that for a minute. But the fact is that this is the way the European imagination saw the Islamic harem in the 19th century, correct? And you might say, what is he doing talking about textiles? Both of these women are as naked as jaybirds. But in fact, if you look very carefully, the venue is set by this Turkish cushion cover back here, and by this Turkish cushion cover right here, and this Turkish embroidery right here. And believe me, the sophisticated audiences who were looking at these paintings by late 19th century French academic painters knew exactly what all these doodads were. They'd seen them all on display in the Musée des Arts Décoratifs in Paris, and they were all, like all civilized people of our time, good museum goers. What happens is there's a whole group of fashion things: harem pants, diaphanous see-through fabrics that show the body underneath. All of this sort of belly dancer, hoochie-coochie imagery that one sees in a particular class of fabrics is associated in Western fashion, not in the Islamic world, but in Western fashion, with the idea of the Ottoman Middle East. Now, in fact, the majority of Orientalist painters who did these harem scenes did not show naked women. They showed clothed women, especially the Brits, who are, it's just too cold to take off your clothes in Britain. People don't even think about it there, I suppose. People probably married for dozens of years and never even seen each other's backs of their napes of their necks. It's also very dark because the sun never shines. But at any rate, what you see here is John Frederick Lewis, perhaps the greatest of British Orientalist painters. And by the way, absolutely drop-dead fabulous watercolorist. These are both watercolors. This man handled watercolors like them. But I mean, you know, we all love Winslow Homer, and you know, and Joseph Mallord William Turner was no slouch. But when it comes to handling watercolors, Lewis was just I think probably one of the greatest masters of that technique who ever lived. And here are two of his Orientalist paintings, and you'll notice that he absolutely revels not only in the fabrics, but very, very much in the cut as well. And in all the details, the narrow goods that finish the edges, the fringes, everything is shown here. Well, again, what is the fascination of this for Europeans? Well, this is the Victorian age, for one thing. And European women are not, at least in public, allowed to wear things like this. So one might say that, in fact, when the nude harem scenes are sexual sublimation for European males, my view is that the paintings by somebody like Lewis here are, in fact, sumptuary sublimation for women who would love to look at these things. And just imagine three or four Victorian ladies sitting around in the parlor, you know, in their whalebone corsets saying, "My God, wouldn't it be nice to actually wear something like that and be able to take a deep breath?" You know, even when you're out, this is called Lilium Auratum in Cairo, and this is just a harem scene by Lewis. But it also goes into other countries. As a matter of fact, one of the things I found most interesting, and I've got hundreds and hundreds of these paintings in an archive, is these are two Spanish painters, not the same Spanish painter, and they're both showing these harem scenes in both cases. Well, one case, it's a group of women playing with a parrot. Over here, it's a bride being prepared for a wedding. And these are spectacular, spectacular textile studies and costume studies. There's a little something wrong over here with this one here. This is actually an Ottoman court carpet on the floor here. It doesn't belong with all the Moroccan stuff here. But, you know, this is probably what he had lying around in the studio. And over here we've got an interesting mélange as well. But, in fact, the interest in textiles on the part of Orientalist painters goes far beyond establishing a venue. It goes far beyond, and indeed, any of the conventional explanations that are offered for it. It is, first of all, an amazing challenge to paint textiles, especially elaborate oriental colored ones, is an amazing challenge to an artist's powers of technique. And also, of course, I think that there was a female audience for these works of art that absolutely reveled in these gorgeous colors and probably wished that they could wear them as well. And this extends to, in popularization, we see this in books, steel engravings like this one here, The Favorite Odalisque. This is an illustration to a book called Constantinople and the Seven Churches of Asia Minor by Thomas Allam, which was deliberately published in England for sale to Protestants from America, especially those who had made this sort of pilgrimage to the seven churches where St. Paul had preached. But he, of course, is going to include a harem scene, too, a very British one here. We've got a little bit of décolletage. That's about as far as it goes. This is The Favorite Odalisque. There is something awfully wholesome about her. You almost expect her to go out and milk a cow. But in fact, this is the sort of thing. This is the way that this idea of Oriental costume was projected on a very popular level. Now, in the preceding century, the Swiss painter Jean-Étienne Lyotard lived in Constantinople for about 20 years and made his life painting visiting Europeans dressed up in Turkish costume. This is Mary Gunning, Countess of Coventry, dressed up a la Turca, on a Turkish carpet, wearing the Turkish entari with the beautiful Turkish belt here, and she is shown as a Turkish harem woman. So you can see that this goes way, way beyond, this interest in Oriental costume goes far, far beyond all conventional Orientalist explanations of it being some kind of exploitative anti-Islamic prejudice. No, it's much more than that. In fact, it is envy, and it is the admiration of these gorgeous fabrics and these gorgeous costumes. And this tradition continues right down to our own day. We know a lot of these costumes, fortunately, have been preserved. You can go to Istanbul, to the museums there, the women's costumes especially, which are not represented in this exhibition here. The 18th century and 19th century embroidered women's costumes that you see here have been collected in Turkey's first and greatest private museum, the Sadberkhanum Museum, the museum of the Koç family in Istanbul. And you can actually study these costumes and see how beautifully they're done. And in fact, the partisans in the 18th and 19th century in Europe of such costumes were women. Mary Wortley Montagu, whose letters written in the first quarter of the 18th century place her as one of the greatest writers in English of the 18th century and one of the first and greatest feminist writers in a long and distinguished tradition in Europe, talks about her own Turkish dress. Here she's shown with her son Edward. Edward was the first English child to receive a smallpox inoculation. She gave it to him in Turkey to protect him. You see her in her Turkish dress. And she describes this dress and other Turkish costumes in enormous, in incredible stitch-by-stitch detail in her letters. And these were widely published and read and admired. And she said, these are much nicer than English costume. They, for one thing, they allow the body to move better. They allow you to breathe. They don't constrain you. They don't cinch you in. They don't give you a bustle on the back where you've got nothing to begin with. They don't do any of this stuff. It's much more honest costume. And she said, and the best thing of all is the veil, because with a veil, a woman can go out on an assignation to meet her lover and pass within 3 feet of her husband on the street, and he'll never have any idea who she is. And in the talk I gave a month ago, I showed this rather extraordinary leotard engraving around the same time, first quarter of the 18th century. This is entitled a Frankish Woman of Pera, that is the European quarter of old Constantinople, going out into making a visit out to town. She's all dressed up to go out on the town. But in fact, the engraving shows the face of Maria Theresia, Empress of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and her daughter superimposed on this. This is Orientalism, but it is the Empress of Austria dressed up a la Turca. And so this tradition, as I mentioned, goes all the way down into our own time, and whether it's by the works of the Spaniard who lived in Venice most of his life, Mario Fortuny, on this side over here, or the somewhat more extreme, and I actually have a problem with this costume for a whole series of reasons, but this is a Turkish designer, Rıfat Özbek, and this is what one might call experimental or avant-garde or cutting-edge, a fashion of late 20th century Orientalism of a very interesting kind. So we've had a little look at the long European appreciation of Orientalist costume, and especially women's costume, because men's costume is rather well taken care of in the show. Now what I'd like to just mention very briefly is the design elements of Ottoman fabrics. That is to say, what is there about fabric design itself that has actually seized the imagination of Western designers, especially those people who make ties that are sold at extremely high prices in museum shops, for which I am a total sucker. And, well, first of all, that there is something, I think it's especially true right now, The Turkish view of flowers is to show them in a way that is absolutely recognizable while at the same time pares them down to their absolute essentials. This is a Turkish carnation. And as it is, here it's seen from the side, here it's seen from the top. As a principle of design, this fits very, very nicely, indeed fits very nicely with almost any kind of European design that we have seen since the 1930s. Almost any period in European design, this is sympathetic material. On this side over here, the most famous and emblematic of all Turkish flowers, the Turkish tulip. A very nice element in textile design. Now, it's been used in European textiles. The Boston Museum has an absolutely gorgeous little embroidered chaplet from the period of Henry VIII with a Turkish tulip on it. So it's been in the European tradition for a long time. Pennsylvania Dutch use this flower all the time. But they use it in the Turkish form, in this pared down, very, very simple form. I think you'll see that these are design elements that are that could be very attractive in the West, the form of the hyacinth over here. Or of the rose. The rose and the rosebud are a good deal more complicated. The form of the curved leaf, which makes its way into all kinds of European design, which influenced French bizarre silk design in Lyon in the 18th century, and the decorated leaf, the leaf here with tulips and rosebuds all over it. These macro photographs are taken from little tiny fragments, little tiny squares of fabrics that have survived in the Topkapı Palace. They were probably sewn into quilts originally. The yardage has perished. Sometimes we have an absolutely drop-dead beautiful pattern. You think, oh my God, I'd love to see that whole pattern. All you got left of it is 4 or 5 square inches of what was originally a bolt about 2 feet wide and 30 feet long. You wonder what happened to the rest of it. So that's what I took all these photos from that treasure house of little tiny fragments in the Topkapı. Or the lotus palmette, or the date palm, whose leaves are decorated with tulips and carnations. There is no Mendelian narrow-mindedness in Turkish, in the Turkish garden. You can have at least a dozen different kinds of flowers all coming off the same stem. Or fruits of one kind or another. These are probably cherries. Or, and this is a pomegranate over here. Well, if you take a look at these things, they're all emblematic. They're all very easily recognizable. They all, and as motifs, they could be very easily abstracted and recombined. This is why designers from the time of William Morris or before and right down to our own time have found these things so attractive. Sometimes Western designers have preferred just to use the vocabulary, a word here, a word there, that's Turkish. Sometimes they take the entire syntax. I never have gotten around to photographing the beautiful set of bedsheets on my bed at home done by Sheridan in Australia in the aftermath of Esen Atel's 1984 Suleiman the Magnificent show in the pattern of one of the most beautiful of the Topkapı kaftan. It comes off very, very well, queen size, I might say. And I sleep very well on it, I might add. And then more abstract designs like the three dots known as Chintamani, originally a Buddhist symbol that became emblematic of Turkey, or the Chinese cloud band, which, being adapted by the Turks, by Islam, takes on an Islamic flavor. These, then, are the vocabulary of Turkish textiles, which has also been the design elements that have appealed tremendously to Westerners. Now, not only as individual motifs, but frequently we can see Western textiles and costumes that have adapted these not only as motifs, but as an entire layout or syntax. For example, the Chintamani, these pearls, usually in groups of three. This is a ballet costume done for Scheherazade, the original Scheherazade of the Ballet Russe de Monte Carlo with the score by Rimsky-Korsakov, the one you all know. You can see the Chintamani, this Ottoman design, used here. And it had this emblematic sense then, and still knowledgeable people today recognize in a fabric what this is. And, of course, these are the harem, the baggy harem pants, too, that I was talking about. Or the lotus palmette arabesque, which is like a stencil with the individual pieces sort of outlined by the background, which you see here in this 16th century engraving by Louis Danet of Fontainebleau, an illustration to one of the best-selling books of the 16th century, The Navigations into Turkey by the Frenchman Nicholas of Nicolay. Or Mariano Fortuny, who was one of the great, he not only loved Turkish cut, he also loved Turkish fabrics. This is a very celebrated early Turkish fabric. It's one of the earliest datable Turkish velvets that we know of, because a couple of them were found in a tomb that we can date to 1548 in Istanbul. And here you can see an adaptation of that. Fortuny had these loomed in Italy and then created these dresses that were in the form of Turkish kaftans. There was a fabulous Fortuny show in about 10 years ago in Vienna where I managed to photograph a number of these wonderful pieces of Turkery. Or the so-called wavy vine layout, in which a swaying vine has leaves coming off of it. Now, this is not a terribly good picture here. It was taken from a perfectly lousy illustration in a cheap catalog of a Christmas creche that I took a few years ago. And here's one of the wise men kneeling in front of the manger. And you can see it's the wavy vine. He's from the Orient. We have seen his star in the east. This is an Oriental king, and he's dressed in an Oriental king's fabric. This is the famous textile museum fabric, one of the most spectacular of all silk fabrics in the history of weaving, let alone Ottoman fabrics, which is in the show right here. Or the layout of enormous blossoms in staggered rows. Now, this is something one can say, well, this is ultimately Chinese in origin. Yes, but the Europeans didn't find out about it from China. They found out about it from the Ottoman Empire. And the angel maybe doesn't come from the east, but comes from straight up. And, you know, it's far away. That's the entire point. So the angel gets to wear something that none of the rest of us get to wear, you know. Or the ogival layout, which is almost always carried with it, the association of luxury. Braunschweig did an entire series of upholstery fabrics inspired by Turkish fabrics. This is, again, one of the celebrated and beautiful pieces from the Textile Museum. And here's another one here, and you can see the ogival fabric, again, from a that automatically signifies the Islamic world, and especially the Ottoman Empire, in this boxed costume from another one, I don't remember which ballet it is. I don't believe it's Scheherazade, but it's another one of the Ballet Russe ballets. So you can see that, at least in the realm of style-setting ballet costume, and certainly in a broader sense as well, that these particular textile designs of the Ottoman Empire have become a part of the repertoire of the West. They have been subsumed into Western material culture. They still carry with them these exotic overtones, but nevertheless, they have, in fact, it's the process of cultural appropriation. And there's nothing wrong with cultural appropriation. Indeed, it's a wonderful thing when it happens. But it's a part of that process of cultural appropriation, which is absolutely central to the continuing genesis and expansion of any art form, whether it be painting, sculpture, architecture, or anything else. Basically, nothing comes from nowhere. I tell my students Denny's two laws of art history. Number one, everything comes from somewhere else. Number two, therefore, everything looks like something else. You know, and it's up to the art historian to tell you what that is. And it's up to you to believe him. Now, I'd like to just conclude here by saying that you know, the today's textile design, fascination with textile designs, is still an ongoing phenomenon in the West. I can't go into details about this, but for the first time in my life, I have actually been enlisted in a lawsuit as an expert witness on the idea of whether or not a modern adaptation of a traditional Turkish textile design, when created by another artist, when created by a 20th century textile designer, when another 20th century textile designer rips off the first textile designer, whether or not the first textile designer can sue the second one. I believe that they can. At least that's the side I'm arguing on. But at any rate, and it's very interesting to me because I when I was approached by this law firm, I said, this is a really interesting case. And he said, well, let's see how you do on this one. We've got seven or eight more waiting in the wings. And these are all cases of an artist adapting a Middle Eastern design and then someone else basically just copying the adaptation. And the adaptations are extremely skillful and actually very clever and very well done. And we've already won the first case. So, but you can see here that when a firm like Anthropology creates these pseudo-Turkish embroideries, which, of course, they call Persian in their catalog. You know, it's really disgusting. You see the carnations down here, the tulips. But anyway, when they recreate these, basically they're asking you to do the very same thing that Henri Matisse did when he put his favorite embroidered yellow Turkish pillow cover, his yastik, with its big carnations in the corners, the red ones, out on the table, and then painted it in a whole series of still lives that he did at home. Now, one can go too far. And indeed, like everything else, fashion designers have gone too far. You remember the famous case of Lagerfeld's Quranic inscriptions on Claudia Schiffer's bodice, which not only caused a fatwa to be issued against him by several ayatollahs, but he apologized because, you know, I mean, this is not appropriate. This is just not appropriate. And don't, by the way, think that this is just something that Lagerfeld does because he's not smart enough to know what he's doing. She is rather attractive, isn't she? But over on this side, over here, we have a. This is perhaps the most blasphemous and offensive painting that any Muslim could imagine: a woman in a low-cut traditional Turkish dress, an antari, sitting in a Quran stand, with the holy books trampled under her feet. Painted in 1888 by a Turk, Osman Hamdi. So one can go too far, but it's amazing, isn't it? What a punch all of this packs. You know, there are kinds of art, I don't think anybody really gets terribly upset. When's the last time you got really upset about a painting? I mean, you know, you thought that a painting was ideologically offensive or something like that. Paintings are not in the forefront today. Costume very much is. It still is. It's the most powerful, the most direct, the most personal of all the arts. So it's right there in the front rows. Well, when we go into the exhibition, who could fail to be inspired by these gorgeous objects that we see downstairs? And, of course, that's exactly the question we should be asking. If any one of us has the slightest bit, and we all do, of course, of ability to recognize beautiful things and to react to them both intellectually and emotionally, why shouldn't we? And if that's true, if something is beautiful, then why shouldn't it form part of the repertoire, the interest, and the creative activity of a young artist today, setting off as a textile designer or as a costume designer? Why shouldn't this form another part of this ongoing blending of cultures, which has such a distinguished 700-year history in European and Western art. Thank you. I guess I can follow the example of my predecessor on this podium and see if anybody has any questions, pertinent or otherwise. Man. Yes. The question was, I showed a view of the interior of one of those marvelous tents in Krakow in Poland, in the Wawel Castle, and I was asked to talk a little bit about those tents. As nearly as we can tell, Ottoman tents, most of the ones that I know, are made out of cotton. And the technique is appliqué. That is, little pieces are colored, and then the colored cotton are sewn onto other pieces of cotton. Sometimes there's wool, and sometimes there's linen. And there's one place in the world where you can go today and see this technique being practiced by dozens and dozens of people down a street, and that's in Cairo. Exactly. And it appears that since Cairo was, after all, Ottoman, after the 15 teens, that many of these tents, like the Ottoman, most of the Ottoman court carpets, which are made out of S-spun wool, were all probably made actually in the Ottoman style, the pure Istanbul Ottoman court style, but that actually were made in Cairo. And these tents, the largest collection in the world is in the Military Museum in Istanbul. The last couple of times I've tried to see it, they've said they weren't on display. Of course, you can imagine conserving these things is a nightmare. It's just that, because they're huge. They cover acres. They're like Barnum and Bailey tents. They're enormous. And the second largest collection is probably in the Topkapi Palace. But those in Poland happen to be in rather remarkable condition. And in 1983, on the 300th anniversary of the lifting of the siege of Vienna, they had all five of them set up and illuminated inside in the Wawel Castle. And that's where I took those photographs. There are panels from these tents in many museum collections. And they're really rather ravishing. And now here, one of the reasons why the scale of the tents is so large, aside from the fact that the tents themselves are gigantic, you've noticed that there's a tendency to show everything in little arched compartments. Yeah. That's, of course, so that many, many people can, you know, so they can be manufactured very, very quickly, and then they sew these arched compartments together to form the entire tent. But also, the designs are very large scale. Appliqué lends itself. These Turkish tulips and all these other flowers, they're perfect for appliqué. They're great for embroidery as well. I mean, that you know, you can do them on a very small scale. But it's very interesting that Turkish embroideries, especially the older ones, there are some small-scale ones, but there are also some very large-scale ones. There's something about projection, and these forms, a technique like appliqué is just perfect for this floral style, which was invented in the Ottoman Empire between 1545 and 1565, largely the result of the work of one artist, a man named Karamemi.
So then those actually predate the Indian tent panels.
Yes. The Indian tent panels that we know are later. And by the way, these tents, a lot of the stuff that was taken in Vienna in 1683 was at least a century old. It had been used. There were Persian carpets from the first half of the 16th century. There were early Turkish carpets. They were antiques. They took, you know, this is amazing. Go out and conquer the enemy and carry along a fortune in antiques with you while you do it, you know? Question.
Thank you.
Okay, well, there were many of them. The Turkish court in the middle of the 16th century especially attracted artists from all over the world. And because the Turks were very compulsive note keepers and record keepers, we have lists of all of these artists. We know how much they were paid every day. There were people there. Let me give you one example. The designers, the people who worked simply making designs and pen on paper, which were then passed on to tile makers, etc. There were two groups. The largest was called the Rumian, that is people from Anatolia, from what is today Turkey, and we assume that you belong to that if you spoke Turkish. There was a smaller but more influential group called the Ajeman, and these were mainly people from Iran. It turns out that they actually were not, most of them, Persians, but what we would call today Azeris. They were from Tabriz, but they came from a different tradition, Turkmen tradition. The Ottoman Empire, when it really begins to form its style, it has its Islamic roots in in Egypt and Syria. That is the Arab traditions. There's the Persian tradition, of course, which, of course, was molded by the fact that the Turks had ruled Persia for a large part of its history. There are the strains that come from Eastern Europe. There is the indigenous Armenian and Byzantine body of art, and of course, of classical art that existed in Anatolia. And then there is always the variable of individual genius. And in the middle of the 16th century, Karamemi and Şakulu, the two greatest Turkish artists of this time, were designing geniuses. They were the Raymond Loewys or the Christian Diors or whatever of their time. They were incredibly creative individuals. Karamemi was from the Rumian, and we know that Şakulu carried the Nisba Baghdadi because his family came from Baghdad, but he was actually an Azeri Turk, as nearly as we can tell. So you have this melting pot. And, of course, great art, you see great art in Spain. When is it at its best? It's at its best when Muslims and Jews and Christians are living together side by side and enriching each other, and there's great commerce. Same thing is true in the Ottoman Empire. So this is an art that comes from everywhere. And in addition, the registers of artists mention people from Bosnia and people from Hungary and people from Georgia and people from Crete and even the occasional Ferenc, which means an Italian or a Frenchman or a German or something like that, you know, a Western European. Sir?
What would the neurological consequences for 16th and 17th century Europeans for coexisting with both cultural appropriation and regarding the Turks who called Shakespeare and the terrible Turks?
Well, that's a very interesting question. It's obviously ambivalence. You know, it's this happens over and over again. Think of Charles V coming into Cordoba and seeing this disgusting 16th century cathedral built in the middle of the most beautiful mosque in the world and saying, you've taken something that was unique in all the world and turned it into something commonplace. And at the same time, he's the Holy Roman Emperor, and his title is Fide Defensor, Defender of the Faith. It's the kind of ambivalence that I think any ideological but intelligent person must always feel. You know, one of the things that I even like to see in politics is the occasional moment of grace when a partisan politician can actually be honest enough, and I'm thinking of people like John McCain and others like that, who could be honest enough to admit that every once in a while a liberal has a good idea, you know, or vice versa. The fact is that that art and ideology tend ordinarily to be enemies. And I think this is marvelous, because art is the enemy of ideology, and art almost always in the long run wins. And that's the side that I'm on, you see. So in the 16th century, it's a very interesting situation. And the best place to see this is in Busbecq, the to my mind, the most candid, the most 20th century, the most advanced, the most fascinating and humane of all 16th century men. And I know him only through his writings, and I not read them in the original Latin. I've only read them translated into English. But he certainly was aware of the foibles and the shortcomings and the bad things that the Turks had done in Europe. But at the same time, he was willing to recognize that there was in the civilization that Europeans were at the same time contemptuous of and terribly, terribly afraid of, that there were many, many wonderful and admirable things which he urged intelligent people of goodwill to look at, to admire, and indeed to appropriate for themselves if they could. And Murray Wortley Montagu was exactly the same. Now, we're dealing in all of these cases with Europeans who had gone to the Middle East and who had lived there and had learned the language and knew enough about it that they were able to appreciate it while never losing their original allegiances. They didn't go native by any means. So this ambivalence is always there. In the case of Nicholas of Nicolay, you know, he talks about how wonderful the Turkish costumes are. Then he says, but the women who wear them are poor morals. You know, he has to slam them in some way. This is cultural ambivalence, and you see it throughout human history. I mean, look at it, it's in the way the Romans felt about the Greeks and the Greeks about the Romans, for example. But it's a central part of this whole East-West business. So neurologically, it's a combination of envy and fear and covetousness. Actually, there are an awful lot of deadly sins in there, and lust, of course. Don't forget lust. We just briefly passed over it in two slides, but it's the big L. It's really very, very important. It's very important in the history of art, too, by the way. If anybody has ever read the probably one of the greatest books in art history ever written, Kenneth Clark's The Nude, you know, talk about that abstract beauty of the female form, yes, but hey, no one would have painted it if it wasn't sexy as all hell, really. They wouldn't. More questions? Yes?
Will globalization mean more cross-fertilization or just everything
being modernized? That's a real problem, isn't it? What is globalization going to do to this whole equation? Well, you know, I mean, it's like, talk about the feeling that ambivalence. I open up that anthropology catalog and I say, isn't this fabulous? They've been inspired by Turkish, you know, embroideries. And then I read the text and it says Persian fantasy. You know, the real enemy is ignorance. That's the real enemy. You know, if I'm a warrior in my life, you know, that's what college professors like to think at any rate. Sometimes they end up propagating it. I hope I'm not. But at any rate, I don't know what's going to happen, quite frankly. All kinds of interesting things are happening, though. And, you know, I'll just give you a couple of examples. Some of you know that one of my major interests is music. There's a series of CDs that have been put out in Germany by a group in Cologne that puts out recordings working with a Turkish ensemble called Sarband on the same record. And they've come out with now three CDs of European music on Turkish themes, Turkish music on Western themes, and combinations of the two. And I think this is wonderful. But you want, and I read something the other day. I'm on the board of a classical music organization, an early music organization in Western Massachusetts, and we're terribly worried about our audiences. Because when I first moved to Amherst 35 years ago and I went to the concerts at Amherst College, I was just about the youngest member of the audience. And now 35 years later I go and I'm still about the youngest member of the audience. And there has been a lot in classical music magazines recently, there's been an awful lot of soul searching and saying that is classical music dying out? Kids don't learn it in school. You know, even my own child has grown up with it. Now, you know, likes to take devil's advocate position against his father and say, well, you know, maybe such and such a rock group is actually better than Beethoven, and did that ever occur to you, Dad? And of course, he just wants to watch my blood pressure rise, you know, watch the veins start standing out in my forehead. And people have been talking about the death of classical music. Classical music recording is really at an all-time low. And then I read this article recently. It said that in China, in the past 10 years, there have been more concert halls built for the performance of Western classical music than in all the rest of the globe together. That those two tall skyscrapers in Kuala Lumpur, the Petronas Towers, used to be the tallest buildings in the world. Maybe you don't realize, but at the base of those towers, what's right between them at the base? The finest concert hall in all Southeast Asia, where the Kuala Lumpur Opera and Symphony Orchestra perform. Every Turkish friend of mine knows more about classical music than any of my colleagues at the University of Massachusetts. I go to the house of a Turkish art historian or a Turkish engineer or a Turkish anything, and he's got Mozart or she's got Bach, you know, all over the place. There are three sets of Bach cantatas being recorded today. John Elliott Gardner, an Englishman, Ton Koopman, a Dutchman. It's funny because I thought Bach was German. And Masahiro, please, last name, the great Japanese interpreter in the Bach Collegium of Japan. And this article said, you know, classical music is alive today in ways that we Europeans and Americans don't even realize. That there are people listening to it all over the world. That there are look at who the great performers are today. You know, well, look at who the great scientists are today. Look at everything. I mean, thank God for Asian Americans, right? So at any rate, this is a very interesting situation where, in fact, we see another kind of cultural broadening. And it's happening in a very, very interesting way. And I think the same thing will happen. I find it very difficult to get a lot of Turks today interested in their own fabrics. There are people that do it. Vako, the Vako firm in Istanbul, is the best. But as long as there are young people in the United States and in Europe and in China and Japan, and there are in Japan, the Japanese are crazy about Turkish textiles. So what we're going to see is we're going to see the perpetuation of traditions outside of their own culture. And I don't think there's anything bad about that. And maybe that's a beneficial I took a long time to answer the question. But I think that may be a very beneficial result of this globalization that we see today. And as for the rest of it, and that is that the entire world will become
become drowned in third-rate American popular music, fifth-rate American films, and 18th-rate other American products. I don't even want to think about that. I somehow believe that there's enough innate good taste in the world that that won't happen. Walmart notwithstanding. Did I actually say that? Excuse me.